This is an ABC podcast.
4, 1, 2, 8.
Snakes and Ladders. A classic game bringing together conservation and the construction industry at last.
I'm on 39. I'm in the middle of a snake. What type of snake's that? I've never seen a purple snake.
Charlie and Liv are playing with me.
If you go in the snake's head, you go down. If you go in a ladder, you go up.
Yeah. 4, 1.
How do you think a snake would actually climb a ladder?
By slithering up the slide.
I think they might curl their body around the side pole of the ladder so they don't lose their balance, and then just go around in a twirling circle kind of motion and keep doing that till they get up the top. But I have never seen a snake climb a ladder, so I don't know.
So a quick Google around.
Does a snake need a ladder to climb?
Trust me, not only can snakes climb ladders, they can climb almost every single thing on Earth. Hello and welcome to What the Duck? I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and today we're on a mission to find out if anywhere on Earth is safe from snakes. I mean, I've seen that documentary movie where the snakes are indeed on a plane, and they are everywhere, despite the COVID travel restrictions. And to demonstrate just how athletic and ultimately effective snakes are, I wanted to hear about one of the most extreme examples that I've heard of snakes being literally everywhere. So we got Dr. Aaron Collins on the line, the Assistant State Director for the US Department of Ag, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. He lives on the American occupied island of Guam, about 1,800 kilometres north of New Guinea.
No one was 100% sure why the birds were disappearing until later when they kind of got the connections together. They just noticed birds were disappearing.
There weren't any snakes on Guam ever before.
Mid-1980s, the last of our remnant bird populations disappeared, and that was brown tree snake, and that it's highly selective on birds in its native habitat.
And the birds, they didn't have any snakes to deal with, so they were completely naive. They were sitting ducks.
The consensus seems that they were probably introduced around 1949 through military cargo. Guam was a major staging area for all the material that moved back towards the mainland United States after the end of World War II. So it could be anything as innocuous as ammo cases to maybe they rode in on a Sherman tank.
They've looked at the genetics, and it could be as few as 10 individual snakes that arrived, or even just one egg-bearing female. That's all it took to wipe out every bird on the island.
No one's 100% sure how many there were because there weren't studies, but it's possible that there were 2 to 4 million snakes by the 80s.
The snakes just ate their way through entire species of birds. Just gone. All because of the brown tree snake.
It's a slender arboreal snake, and it's nocturnal, so that makes it a tough animal to deal with.
And it's got big cartoon-like eyes to deal with the dark. And yeah, this is actually a snake that's native in part to northeastern Australia.
They usually don't get above 900 millimeters. However, on Guam, they had the good fortune to not have predators and not have any major competitors. So you have brown tree snakes that were reported to be almost 3 meters. And right now, based on the modeling and the research, there's about 1 to 2 million snakes at this time estimated to be there. So about 10 snakes a hectare.
Too many snakes. The island's biggest population of predators had been the birds. So when the snakes ate them all, it caused what's called a trophic cascade. Like a delicately balanced pile of books, you pull one book out and the whole thing collapses.
An example is we have 40 times the density of spider webs to our neighbors because there are not a bird predator. I guess they didn't want to count spiders. It was easier to count webs between the islands. You see forests that cannot easily regenerate themselves. The fruit drop directly below the parent trees.
Because the birds aren't there anymore to transport the seed around after eating the fruit.
hopefully, when the parent tree dies, the canopy opens, then it may be replaced by its same member. One animal has an extraordinary impact just in the ecological sense.
It's also financially expensive, with an estimated $4.5 million a year in damages. Plus, the snakes keep cutting the power supply.
They're long and slender, so they can easily basically short circuit power lines, go across insulators so that they're short circuit different transmission lines. And so in the 70s and 80s, when of course this population was even higher, they were getting island-wide power outages that could last days from these snakes.
There's stories of snakes climbing over snakes that are climbing power poles, of nowhere on the island being safe from a snake searching for food, because the brown tree snake turned out to be an incredibly elastic and plastic species, able to go anywhere, eat anything, and seemingly do anything at once.
We actually often joke that it's like Frankenstein's monster. Nothing stops them.
But how? How do snakes climb trees? I mean, it's not like they've got a ladder or arms.
I have been messing around with snakes for more than 40 years now.
And if there's one bloke to ask about how snakes move, it's Bruce Jane, Snake Superman. Bruce is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he's a worldwide doyen of snake movement.
My, how time flies when you're having a good time.
Think of those images you see of athletes on a treadmill in slow motion and all the scientists are looking on. Well, Bruce is one of those scientists, but for snake athletes.
A really noteworthy feature of snakes, of course, is they are long and skinny.
Yeah, and even though snakes don't have feet, they do have gait. And just like you can walk and jog and run and skip and pull yourself up and push yourself away, snakes have multiple ways of getting around too. But how does a tube of meat do that? How do you even start to build the perfect snake?
And they have become long and skinny, not as a result of elongating individual body segments, but having a huge number of body segments.
It's sort of like a Swedish modular snake system called snäck, where you build it end on end, and the number of vertebrae that can be in a snake varies between species. It can sometimes exceed 300 individual sections.
And then, of course, layered on top of the skeleton, you also have muscles that go from vertebra to vertebra, vertebra to rib, and rib to rib, in some cases from the ribs to the skin and so on.
Their muscles and tendons are incredibly cross-braced, which means they're both robust and flexible. Bruce says that even though he's dissected roadkill snakes, the ribs are often crushed, but he's never found one with a broken spine. And there are thick snakes, itty-bitty snakes, and Mississippi snakes, and inner-city snakes, pretty snakes. I'm getting distracted. My point is, different snake body types have different athletic strengths. And the most common way we probably actually imagine snakes moving is wiggling, you know, moving side to side in order to go forward.
Commonly, when you see a snake bent from side to side, and it looks like an S, or more commonly a series of S's, that's referred to as lateral undulation. So when snakes use that type of movement, those bends travel from head to tail. And then when they encounter little irregularities, they bump against unyielding surfaces in the environment that provide a reactive force that helps to push the snake forward.
And making S shapes is not the only way that snakes move. And by God, it just gets more and more creepy from here on out. So brace yourself.
But there is another common way that one might see a snake crossing a road. And many pythons actually can keep their body perfectly straight, but wiggle the skin relative to the skeleton in a form of locomotion that's known as rectilinear locomotion. And snakes are effectively the only limbless reptiles that have some specialized muscles that extend from the ribs to the skin that allow them to move the skin relative to the skeleton and perform this rectilinear type of locomotion.
So they're not wiggling their spine. They're literally skin crawling. And they might use this, maybe, says Bruce, if they're trying to go down a pipe or a burrow, but only if it was casually and they weren't in a rush.
But there's yet another way that snakes can move when they're in skinny spaces. And that type of movement is called concertina locomotion. And within the confines of tunnels, the way snakes do this is bend their body from side to side and then press against the sides of the burrow to sort of create an anchor point. And then after bunching up, they extend those bends to move forward. The process then repeats.
So they zigzag their body, push against the sides with their butt end, and then they're able to move their front end forward. But if you imagine not a snake in a tube, but a snake on a tube, instead of pushing outwards to give itself a platform to move from, it squeezes in around the tube with its rear end. Imagine one of those clamp desk lights, you know, it holds on by squeezing the desk at the base, and its head is able to move and swivel and explore. This is how snakes can also move across skinny branches in trees and also bridge gaps between branches too.
It's like, whoa, how did it go so quickly from there to there and how to do it with ease and how they know how to do it from being a baby. Like we've released hatchling carpet python and they just do it just like
really?
That.
Really? Stuart McKenzie is from Sunshine Coast Snake Catchers. They've got a bazillion followers on social media and their very own National Geographic TV program too.
When you compare these animals to how, I guess, useless humans are as a baby, you know, snakes are amazing. They literally hatch out or they get born as a live birth, and basically as soon as they come out, they are on their own. And sometimes to even watch a python, they use this technique to climb directly up a trunk of a tree, so up like a palm tree or something, where they kind of coil their body around the trunk and then push up and then wrap their head around, and then the rest of their body comes up like a spring and then it pushes off again. It's mesmerizing to watch.
They edge up the tree like a gravity-defying slinky with fangs. But just how high can a snake actually climb?
Yeah, so we've caught them 4 or 5 stories up a high-rise building. I've caught a python and a tree snake, so 2 occasions, where we had to get in the help of one of the big electrical companies to bring out a cherry picker and go to the top of a Telstra tower.
That's a telephone tower.
Where there was a snake just curled up the top. It had climbed up using just the little rungs on the side of the pole and, going all the way to the top. You know, I've seen snakes scale the side of a building where it's a brick building, so the tiniest little grooves for a snake to get its body on, but it goes straight up the wall with ease. They're incredible climbers. We obviously get a lot of snakes in roof spaces.
So is there anywhere, then, that a snake can't go?
Oof. Gee whiz, I haven't actually thought about that. I really don't think there's anywhere that a snake can't get to.
How about the top of a skyscraper?
If it wanted to go up, it could get to the top of a 100-story building. No drama.
Oh, no, it's fine. I will outrun the snake using my car.
We've had them go into engine bays and not being able to get them out because they find that gap. You know, I've taken the car to a mechanic and they start pulling it apart carefully. And we still can't find the snake, but it's 100% in there.
No, that's good. I've got a big fence around the house. That'll keep them out.
But they can basically squash down to probably half, if not a third of their body size when you see them normally, and squeeze through a gap. So basically they get their head through and the body's most likely going to follow.
Okay, I'm going to be inside. It's fine. They don't know how to use a doorbell.
So if you've got a lock sliding door with security doors, right, a snake can get in by going into the sliding door grooves down the bottom and basically travel under the sliding door in that little gap and then come out the other side. You know, we've caught snakes in the back of fridges. We've caught snakes in the air vents of a car. We've caught snakes under pillows. You know, we've literally caught snakes everywhere.
Do you think that snakes are sort of like perfect machines?
Well, I'm reluctant to say anything's perfect, but I would say they are spectacularly successful machines.
Yeah.
And over the years, there's been increasing interest in snakes to design snake-like robots.
Now there's a terrifying thought, a bloody robot snake. And it turns out that several people have actually made careers working on this sort of thing.
My name is Kristin Pettersen, and I'm a professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology.
Kristin is the sort of person who looks like she should be anticipating a weekend of cross-country skiing. But instead, she's chosen to specialise in changing the future of underwater mining or warfare or something by attaching tools to a snake.
So it's the mobility of the snake robots that's important for us, and it is a robot manipulator arm that is transporting itself. So you can equip it with a gripper in one or in both ends, and it can pick up things, it can push buttons, it can turn valves. So they are extremely useful as well as extremely fascinating.
One of the strengths is that, just like biological snakes, they can go places that traditional robots on tracks or wheels, for example, can't go. Think collapsed buildings, for example. The snake robot can move right through and into that rubble.
In robotics, it's a lot about obstacle avoidance. But if you watch biological snakes, they don't avoid obstacles. They use them. So they move towards the obstacle and push against them in order to propel themselves even faster forward. So that is something that we've built into the brains, the algorithms of our terrestrial snake robots. But we also want to do that for swimming snake robots, being able to sense the vortices surrounding it and pushing against these in order to move as efficiently forward as possible.
Yes, you heard that correctly. Swimming snake robots. They can feel the pressure of the water, they can move of their own accord, they know where they are and undertake missions on behalf of, according to Kristin, on behalf of humanity.
So there are 95% of the oceans that has never been explored, and they contain so many interesting things. They contain food, they contain minerals, they have energy that can be harvested. So that is our main target now, to create swimming snake robots that can help us explore the oceans, and also that can help us maintain the man-made equipment that we have placed there, for instance, subsea oil and gas installations and aquaculture installations.
Of course, there's still a bit of work to go. There are some things that are really hard to replicate, like scales, for example, on the terrestrial robots. And in the water,
they can't stand still in water.
Right.
Yeah. Then the ocean currents would make them drift away.
Yes.
So our snake robots, we have made, for instance, the Mamba robot. It moves so elegantly around in water.
This Mamba robot looks like a really thick black sea snake. And the researchers have helpfully put some little clear bits where the eyes should go so you know which end is which, and they've got LED lights in them, and they glow red. It's like it's straight from a horror movie. No offence, Kristin.
It's so beautiful in its motion, I think, and it's perfect for moving around effortlessly and observing. But if you wanted to do something to, for instance, turn a valve or pick up something from the seafloor, it runs into problem. In order to stand still, it has to move back and forward and back and forward. The undulations have to change its direction all the time to kind of stand still. So why not combine the best from biology with the best from technology? Why not combine the slender and flexible body of the snakes with thrusters?
Yeah, I read about the thrusters, and these are really quite small, aren't they? They're not like, we're not talking like the Starship Enterprise here.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. I have to ask, though, one of the things that often happens when you see robotic creatures is that uncanny valley feeling, that almost real, almost biological, but not quite. So are the snake-like robots, are they a bit creepy?
I find when it comes to humanoids, and in particular robot faces, then I really sense this uncanny feeling when it's sort of almost human, but not. But when it comes to snakes, I don't get that feeling at all. Maybe it's because biological snakes, they are a little bit uncanny, aren't they? In the way that they
already are.
Well, yeah, they are. So, and the snake robots, they are a little bit more toy-like. It has this pet-like feeling, and it has sort of a personality, and it's cute.
That's wonderful to hear, because the idea of a snake with thrusters attached to it is pretty terrifying. Almost as terrifying as a snake that can outwit the collective brains of scientists. And it actually takes us back to Guam and the brown tree snake that can climb anything and ate every bird on the island. Conservationists were trying to come up with a way to snake-proof bird nesting boxes. Professor Bruce Jane.
But the problem arises if you have a nest box and you have it on a pipe. Can a predatory snake actually climb up that pipe to reach the nest box? So a very logical plan of attack that my colleagues used is to have a huge, smooth cylinder beneath the nest box. And this seemed really promising for just being too slippery and too hard to grip for the snakes to climb up that surface.
The researchers were hoping to find the Goldilocks pole, not too small, not too big, just right to stop the snakes. So they settled on an 8-inch stovepipe. Wide, slippery, perfect.
And then, much to their surprise, when they started going through the surveillance footage, their design was a failure. The snakes were able to crawl up.
And how the snakes did this is one of the creepiest things I have ever beheld. They tied themselves into a slipknot.
So one of the reasons why we decided to call it lasso locomotion is simply because of the shape of the snake. Obviously, in a lasso, if you pull on the end of the lasso, you tighten it, and there's nothing that really is pulling on the end of the snake to tighten the loop. A snake sort of self-tightens the loop.
And so the snake moves around the base of the pipe, and you see its tail curl over its body where they meet. And then you see waves appear in the loop.
So one of the things those little bends accomplish is providing the squeezing forces on the cylinder. But then the other thing is those little bends travel in the direction from head to tail around the circumference of the cylinder. So there's a tiny bit of lifting that occurs as that bend travels from the head towards the tail of the snake within the loop.
It is truly incredibly weird to see an animal use its own body like a piece of rope and wiggle it up a pylon. It's a nope rope going up a slope. And it makes me wonder if there is anything at all that a snake can't do.
Yes, if you make surfaces smooth enough and slippery enough.
Like a completely featureless mirror.
If you tip that surface up, if I tip them up at an angle between about 20 to 30 degrees, the snakes will just slide down every time. And because it's a flat, smooth surface, there's nothing for them to grab onto.
Well, there's going to be people out polishing smooth vertical walls around their houses in Australia now you've said that.
4, 1, 2, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4.
What sound would a snake make if it went down a slide? Okay. Well, I've got a friend named Bruce, and he says that sometimes they squeeze a branch to let themselves down gently, and sometimes they just attempt a controlled slide like they're on a slippery dip at a playground.
It'd be like... One.
He also said that snakes, in general, cannot move backwards. But that, my friends, is a topic for a different episode of What the Duck. And if you've got questions about snakes or anything in the natural world, actually, send us an email, whattheduck@abc.net.au. Patria Ladgrove and I produce What the Duck. Script editing is by Joel Werner, and we produce it mostly from Wadawurrung and Kaurna country, with the help of experts from all over the world.
Is that a snake going down the ladder? Sideways?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.